It's Wednesday, January 7th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, our weekly take on media behavior from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, sitting in for Amy Simons this week, and joining me are Missouri School of Journalism colleague Ernest Perry and Bob Priddy, who's just retired after 40 years as news director of the Missouri Net. Our topics this week: terrorists kill 12 people at the offices of a Paris newspaper that satirizes Islam. A Jefferson City Weekly that covers state government accuses the Columbia Tribune of trying to sabotage a competitor. Has a loss of institutional memory hurt the people's business in the state capitol? We'll talk about that. Historians question whether the new film Selma accurately portrays a former president. And we'll consider the legacy of ESPN's Stuart Scott, who died from cancer last Sunday. First to Paris, where authorities say three gunmen shot and killed a dozen people at the offices of the weekly newspaper Charlie Hebdo. The paper has run cartoons and other content satirizing radical Islam and the Prophet Muhammad. In the past, Hebdo has been firebombed for that coverage. Today, its cover page featured a controversial author who's released a fictional account of France in 2022 under an Islamic president. The real French president, François Hollande, calls the shootings today a terrorist attack of the most extreme barbarity. Video shows the gunmen running through the streets of Paris. An eyewitness quotes one of them as saying, "The prophet is avenged." As of our taping, they had not been caught. 10 of those murdered were journalists, including the paper's editor and chief cartoonist. The other two victims were police officers guarding the office. Well, Ernest, you know, 2015 has started where 2014 left off. Islamic fundamentalists are terrorizing the public and killing journalists.
Well, this is one of the things that the Obama administration and others in Europe were concerned about, was the Islamic State had operatives in all over Europe, and some say here in the United States, even though we haven't seen any of that. And they were afraid of them making these kinds of actions in terms of going after individuals and having these sort of terroristic acts within, you know, European capitals and at specific targets. And this newspaper, which has long been known as one of the targets for not just this group, but other Islamic terrorist groups, I mean, there was a reason why those police officers were there.
Well, and they haven't been the only journalists who've been threatened because of running these sorts of controversial cartoons or articles. We remember the Dutch publication a few years ago that ran a contest for the cartoons of Muhammad, and they were threatened. And I just wonder, Bob, if that and all the other things we saw in the past 12 months with regard to journalists being kidnapped, beheaded, is there an additional chilling effect from what's happened today on journalists, commentators, cartoonists?
I think from time to time you're going to see that, but it does. All this does is point out that this is sometimes a very dangerous profession that we're in, this business of journalism. There are always going to be people who don't want you to say something or don't want you to express an opinion, and that might be emphasized with some of the extreme things we're seeing, but at the same time, there are more subtle efforts, too, that are always underway, even in our own local communities, where people want to control the messenger and the message it gets out.
I think, too, Ernest, I mean, this just plays into the hands of some stories that we're going to be covering in 2015 anyway with regard to right-wing parties, anti-EU political parties growing in Europe. This kind of story is going to add weight to that coverage.
Yeah, you're going to see that because, I mean, you have the – I know in the UK they're having their elections coming up this year, I think in May, in which they're going to be voting for a new prime minister. And one of the big issues there is immigration. And a lot of that immigration is coming from not only from Islamic countries but also coming from Eastern Europe. So you're going to have those kinds of right-wing extremists happening there. France is dealing with it right now in terms of their election and their political structure. And a lot of it was talked about in this newspaper and other newspapers there about the rise in this sort of right-wing fanaticism, which is sort of pushing back against Islam, and Islam is pushing forward in what it's trying to do.
Well, clearly this story is still developing, and we'll probably have more to say about it on the show next week. But let's move to a story a little closer to home. And what might on the surface seem like an intramural spat has tongues wagging this week in Jefferson City. In Sunday's Columbia Daily Tribune, state government reporter Rudy Keller writes about parties thrown at the Missouri Times. It's a weekly that also covers the state capitol. Apparently those parties, which honored lawmakers, were paid for in part by lobbyists, but the Tribune says most of those lobbyists didn't report their sponsorship to the Missouri Ethics Commission. The editor of the Times, Scott Fawn, struck back with a column defending its parties, personally attacking Rudy Keller, and accusing the Tribune of running the story just as the Times was beginning to print
in Colombia. So, Bob, you know the players involved. And so what's your first take on this dust up?
Well, my first take is that this is one of those things where Scott should have written a column and put it in his desk drawer to let it cool off overnight and then thought about it again the next morning. I don't know whether he was on a deadline or not when he wrote it, but I think he went a little bit too far in his response. It was more a retort than it was a response, and the political attack on Rudy was uncalled for. If you look at Rudy's story, and I looked at it the other day, I think I counted there were 43 paragraphs in his story, including some that are only a sentence long. And of that number, I think I counted 18 having something to do with the Missouri Times and these parties. That none of the sentences was critical of the Missouri Times. None of them accused the Missouri Times of violating any journalism ethics. The story was about ethics reform and about lawmakers reporting their expenditures at events that had an influence on the legislature and members of the legislature. That's what the story was about. Scott took it as an attack on his newspaper, and it wasn't that at all if you look at what was written. And I'm sure that had he had a chance to cool off and maybe talk to some other people about it, he might have had a different attitude. But I think that his response was probably over the top.
Well, clearly he wrote that this was basically the Tribune payback for the fact that a competitor is now going to be putting its paper into boxes here in Columbia. And it does say, whether that's true or not, I mean, it does say something about the strain that's been going on the past few years between sort of the legacy media operations like yours, the Post-Dispatch, the Tribunes, and some of these more recent, you know, online publications or others that are trying to cover state government themselves.
Well, the Capitol Press Corps does have guidelines for admission to its membership, and that means space the press table in the Senate and the House. It means parking spaces, office spaces within the complex. And organizations have to show that they are not in some way or another partisan, or that they're not in some way or another financed by and published by special interest groups before they're allowed to be part of the Capitol Press Corps. Scott's newspaper, the Missouri Times, had to do that. I was one of those who thought it was just fine to begin with, so I didn't have a problem with it. But they nonetheless had to go through that probationary period, and he likes to portray his newspaper, or he did in his article, as the ultimate outsider. And in many ways, I suppose it probably is. They're a weekly, not a daily. They don't really hang around with the rest of the press corps very often. And so this is the kind of an outsider thing. But in terms of whether the Tribune is trying to strike back because the Missouri Times is going to have its free newspapers available in Columbia, that I think is just not acceptable. I don't think Hank Waters, whose name is misspelled twice in the article, by the way, I don't think Hank Waters has lost 1 second of sleep because the Missouri Times is going to be giving away its free newspapers here.
Well, let's put this in a slightly larger context. And Ernest, I think we've talked about this a lot before on the show. There's a recent national study that shows only a third of America's newspapers, the daily papers, have a reporter assigned to their statehouse. Only 14% of TV stations do that. And we've talked a lot about this problem and, you know, even given kudos to some of these startups who, even if they're partisan, because they're trying to shine more light on state government.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good that you're having this coverage, but I think what it really points to, and I agree with what you're saying about that article, I went back and read it, and you're absolutely right. It talks more about the lack of transparency in terms of ethical lapses or what could be perceived as lapses on the part of state legislators, and the fact that you actually have a predominantly Republican controlled legislature that really wants to do something about it. That's what surprised me, and that's what I liked about Rudy's article. But you're not getting a lot of that coverage, except from places like the Columbia Daily Tribune. I mean, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch does have a reporter there in Kansas City, but they're only there during the session. So you're not getting any of this kind of coverage from there.
They're year-round.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I mean, part of the problem is that I think you need to have more coverage of things like this. And this kind of going back and forth and sniping among journalists, I think, does more harm than good.
Well, let's get beyond the sniping a little bit. And Bob, let's talk about something I know you've been concerned about for several years, and that's this decline in institutional memory at the State House, whether it's on the part of the politicians because of term limits or just the relative lack of interest of media companies to have reporters down there.
Well, I think it's pretty devastating. We've seen the press corps shrink, and part of that is because there are fewer newspapers. I mean, we used to have 2 St. Louis papers and 2 Kansas City papers, and each had their own bureaus. Well, we don't have that. We have a lot of newspapers in outstate Missouri, St. Joe, Cape Girardeau, and Joplin, and so on, that used to have people on the scene. They don't anymore. And so we have basically one wire service, not two anymore at the Capitol. We have the newspapers that are there. We have the Missourinet that is there. But state government is the most intimate part of government. That is that's where the decisions are made that have the most direct and most immediate impact on the way all of us here and all of us listening and watching live our lives. But the newspapers in the state of Missouri and the news media, including television stations from the metro areas, simply don't think that what goes on in the Capitol is important news. What goes on in the Capitol is a local news story every single day, because what they do in that Capitol impacts everything we do within our communities and our counties every day. That's local news. And if I'm sorry that my fellow journalists can't see that as being a great local news story and actually provide a service to the people that they have as their consumers, but they need to do it.
Well, say just a little bit, too, about this whole issue of term limits and whether that has led to a lack of institutional memory and more hyper-partisanship in Jeff City.
Well, I've said before, and I'll say it again, I think term limits is the worst thing that's happened to Missouri politics since Reconstruction. And it's taken away a lot of institutional memory. And it's important that we have that institutional memory, because there are people down there that need to know what works and what doesn't work. And there are people who need to know how to get along with other folks. And with term limits, there's much less need to get along with other people. We have an awful lot of folks coming into Jefferson City right now who know they're going to be there a short amount of time. They have their own agenda, and it's a matter of get the heck out of the way. I'm going to pass my bills, and I don't have to be nice to you if I want them done.
Well, the Missouri legislative session, by the way, just got underway today at noon with all the ceremonial stuff. And so let's look ahead a little bit to some of the issues that might dominate debate in the House and the Senate this coming term. And I know one of the things, Ernest, that everybody's talking about is Ferguson and what's the impact of Ferguson is going to be on the legislature. You want to take a quick crack at that?
Well, I mean, it's going to be real interesting to see, because, I mean, you have several legislators, and many of them are from the St. Louis area, who want to deal with this. I mean, they want to launch investigations. They want to look into why certain things were done or weren't done. They want to look at the governor's actions concerning that. In terms of legislation, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not there's anything passed that's going to deal with the school issue over in St. Louis, which they've talked a lot about. Is there going to be some legislation that's going to deal with the fact that we have all these municipalities that have their own fines and fees and that sort of thing, and how it crosses over and what kind of impact that has? I mean, I know those are things they're talking about, but it's going to be interesting to see whether anything tangible is going to come from the legislature, or is it just going to be a bunch of politicians in front of cameras, in front of microphones, basically spouting off what should and shouldn't be done, but really nothing happens.
Yeah, and one of the major issues is going to be whether there should be special prosecutors for grand juries in the case of police shootings. That might be the one that comes out of this, because the rest of it is going to have so many different elements to it that it's going to be hard for anything to coalesce mm-hmm. on these issues.
So what other issues, quickly, Bob? I mean, we talked about ethics in the earlier story. Is that going to be a big thing? Medicaid reform, they're going to talk about that again and not do anything? Education, what's going to be on the
agenda?
Well,
Medicaid reform is going to be up again, I'm quite sure, and there are still going to be the same roadblocks, the same couple or three senators, for example, that are going to try to stop it every time it does come up. So the backers of Medicaid expansion have to figure a way to get over them. We're going to have some interesting budget discussions. This year, unlike last year, the legislature and the governor agree on how much money is going to be available. That was a big stumbling block last year. So that's going to be worried about. The new legislation that allows the legislature to override withholds by the governor, we're going to have to see how that plans out or plays out, because we've got some significant money problems yet. Ethics, I suspect we're going to talk an awful lot about ethics. We have a lot of bills introduced, but the legislature has been down this road so many times and has done absolutely zilch that if we get an ethics bill that really amounts to a hill of beans, I think it might be close to a miracle.
You know, and I think that the whole issue of term limits has a lot to do with the problems we have in passing ethics legislation, because it seems like every time there seems to be sort of a push into doing that, you know, we have a couple more new legislators come in who don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a problem.
Well, you know, you're asking people to do something that limits the amount of money that they can have for their campaigns or the amount of gifts that they can take during a legislative session. You're asking members of the legislature to say, I'm going to pass a law that limits the amount of influence that I can be exercised against me or on me. And, you know, it takes a certain amount of courage to do that. I don't know.
Well, we're going to take a big turn here, and I think it'll become apparent why in just a minute. But several Oscar-worthy movies have been released in the past couple of weeks. One of them is Selma, which depicts the Civil Rights March in Alabama. And while many folks are praising the film overall, some are not all that happy with the way that the director, Ava DuVernay, depicts former President Lyndon Johnson as a reluctant supporter of voting rights who even sicked the FBI on Martin Luther King Jr. Mark Updegrove, who's the director of the LBJ Presidential Library, wrote an article in Politico saying the movie tries to, quote, bastardize one of the most hallowed chapters in the civil rights movement. He gave a somewhat more measured defense of Johnson Sunday on Face the Nation.
There's a conversation that anyone can listen to. It's a taped telephone conversation between Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson that took place on January 15, 1965, that largely vindicates Johnson and really shows his passion around voting rights. The two of them spur each other on, more or less. And Johnson says to Martin Luther King, you know, if you show the very worst of voting rights oppression in the South and get it on TV and get it on the radio, get it in the newspapers, there isn't a fellow who drives a tractor who won't say that isn't right.
The director of the film says the notion that Johnson somehow came up with the idea for the March on Selma is jaw-dropping and offensive. Well, Ernest, both you and Bob are historians, and I'd like to get both of your takes on this dispute.
Well, I've read several articles, including the article that was written by the director of the LBJ Library, and to a certain extent, I think that they're correct in terms of the way in which the movie, at least from what I've seen, depicts LBJ. LBJ did a lot to sort of help push the Voting Rights Act, for sure. I mean, because there were people within his own administration who did not want him to go after the Voting Rights Act in 1965. They thought once they got the Civil Rights Act of 64 passed, that was enough. And LBJ said, no, we need to do this now, because if we don't, we're not going to get it. And that sort of did play into what Dr. King and others were trying to do in the South. Now, in terms of who made the decision to go into Selma, I think most civil rights historians will agree that it was the SCLC and King who had made a decision and realized that they needed to find a place in order to be able to demonstrate the problems with voting rights. And Selma was the perfect place to do that.
So, Bob, does it matter after all these years if a movie takes liberties with how the president did or didn't behave in the situation?
I think it always matters when you try to portray something erroneously, and where if you take liberties with history, because people are going to look at movies like this or JFK or some of the other movies that we've seen that are based on a true story. That's a key line, based on a true story, which means there have been liberties taken. And so if you distort history, I think you're doing a disservice to the viewing public, even though it might help the public go buy a lot of tickets. The fact is, these are the things that happened under Lyndon Johnson's watch. And that's the cumulative effect that I think is the important thing to remember about Lyndon Johnson, is that it happened under his watch.
Well, unfortunately, it's not surprising that many of the issues that are raised in the movie Selma are continuing to dominate news coverage today and in the year ahead, and we'll keep following that. The history of this next story is a bit more recent. 22 years ago, a young reporter named Stuart Scott joined the team at ESPN. He became one of the sports network's signature talents. Scott died Sunday morning after a long struggle with cancer. He was 49. Scott's colleagues had known that the end was coming, and they'd prepared a 14-minute tribute that aired first on SportsCenter. Near the beginning of that tribute, Scott Van Pelt and Dan Patrick recall how Stewart changed the face of sports journalism on TV.
Booyah. That's it. In a word, that's what he brought to SportsCenter.
Going into the night.
He brought his own attitude and energy and lexicon.
Third inning, Derek Jeter in first. Booyah! Alex Rodriguez, second homer in two nights.
And he owned that distinctive style of doing the show the way he wanted to do it.
He didn't push the envelope. I mean, he bulldozed the envelope. And the fact that he was willing to try something new, you know, you had white guys in their 30s, all with catchphrases. Stewart certainly wasn't that.
You know, this kid is as cool as the other side of the pillow. Three-run shot to left.
I'm wondering if you believe that Stuart Scott made a big difference in his two decades at ESPN. I mean, now, obviously his style was different, but what was his legacy, you think?
I think his style was different, but I think his legacy was that he brought a different audience, a different generation into these shows, because you have to remember that, you know, SportsCenter was sort of in his infancy then, and it needed something or someone to push it, and Stuart Scott was one of those people that actually brought it into sort of the mainstream. I mean, I was looking at all the coverage of it when it was announced that he had passed away, and it reminded me a lot of when Peter Jennings passed away. I mean, you had people who were outside of the sports arena actually commenting about it, the president and others. And that means that, he did have that much of an impact. But one of the things that I remember was that a couple of years ago, one of my former grad students who's now at KU, teaching at KU, we did a study looking at the kind of language that they were using on SportsCenter, a lot of it attributed to Stuart Scott, and what kind of an impact that language had on the writing of sports journalism. And what we found was that a lot of what he and others at ESPN were doing was starting to gravitate into the sports writing that you see in the newspaper today. And that was something that was sort of causing some conflict among the old line editors and then the new journalists who were coming in and writing.
Well, and clearly, Bob, his career dovetailed with ESPN rising to become probably the dominant cable television network in the country. And I wonder if you think that he had something to do with that rise.
I think a person, everybody brings a certain spirit to an operation, and if they're good at it, they stay there. And if what they bring is genuine and enthusiastic and intelligent, then somebody like Stuart Scott is going to be at a place like ESPN for a long time. And whether it booyah is something that became part of his lexicon and other aspiring sports people now have adopted it, unfortunately, because it's natural with him. And that's another thing that I liked about watching Stuart Scott, is everything he did and everything he said seemed to be just natural. There wasn't anything manufactured by him. And it's so easy, I think, with a lot of sports people, sportscasters these days, to kind of try to manufacture something for themselves. And I just thought he was a natural. That's one of the attractive things about
him. I think he was a natural, and he reached an audience that ESPN had not reached before. Yeah. And he brought those people into it. And I think the diversity that you see within ESPN is one of the things that that's part of his legacy, because he naturally brought that in.
Well, and there's obviously something to be said as well for an example that he set by working through some very difficult health problems, and not just the cancer. He'd been hit in the eye by a ball early in his career and had to wear glasses, and people made fun of him. So he really had to overcome a lot of things to keep working at the high level that he
had. And I think what people are also hearing in the stories about him is that a lot of the hate mail that he received and a lot of actual threats against his life that he received throughout his career because of what he was trying to do and trying to bring, and what he eventually brought to ESPN and to sports in general.
Well, finally, we're going to take a look at a 15-year-old story that drew millions of listeners to a new podcast last year. Most of our listeners and viewers are probably familiar with Serial from the producers of This American Life. In case you're not, reporter and host Sarah Koenig reopened the case of Adnan Syed, who was convicted of killing his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee, largely through the testimony of Jay Wilds. Wilds claimed that he helped dispose of the body after Syed threatened Jay's girlfriend and promised to tell police about his drug dealing. Well, Serial ended after 12 episodes last month, with Koenig unwilling to exonerate Syed, but she did say that holes in Jay's testimony led her to believe that the teenager shouldn't have been convicted. Koenig and her producer tried to interview Jay at his home in California.
We did not warn Jay we were coming, which is not the gentlest reporter move, I know. But I thought we'd have the best chance of success if we met him face to face, so we could make our case for why we wanted to talk to him, and he could have a better sense of who we were and what we were about. But because it's also sort of a dick move to show up at someone's door like that, Julie and I were nervous. I am so hyped up. Listening back to the tape, I wanted to give myself a Xanax. But I feel super excited to talk to him, like so excited to talk to him, I can't tell you. Like if this works, and he knows everything we want to know. Every question we've had for the past 8 months, 7 months, he knows it. And whether or not he tells us is a different thing. But you know what I mean? Like, he's like, there's a treasure chest of
answers that we've been looking for this whole time, and he has it.
Jay Wilds did let them in, but he refused to give a taped interview, and it was one of the biggest missing pieces of the Serial podcast. Well, last week, the online news source The Intercept scored a coup. Jay gave an interview to reporter Natasha Vargas Cooper. In it, he changed his account once again, and he accused Koenig of harassing him and creating an evil stereotype of him. Well, that's not the impression you might get from the emails that Koenig sent Jay, as well as her public offer to create another episode of the podcast if Jay was willing to talk to her. Meanwhile, convicted killer Adnan Syed has another appeal hearing scheduled this month, and we'll see whether Jay's interview with The Intercept or other information to come forward in recent months will lead to a new trial. I want to focus, though, in our last couple of minutes on the media aspects of this. And Ernest, I'll start with you. At the very least, if you look at the emails and if you look at the podcast, Koenig was trying to shine a light on some really big problems in our society with the criminal justice system. Eyewitness testimony, police and prosecutorial misconduct, potentially, reasonable doubts. So say a little bit about that.
Well, I think what this basically shows is that, at least to me, is that if you have a very good attorney who understands the system, then you're probably going to have a better outcome with the criminal justice system. If you don't, then you run into these issues because prosecutors are going to do whatever they can to try to win that case. And sometimes they step over the line. And you can say the same thing about the law enforcement as they're investigating it. And then once you get into the appeals process, some things are accepted, some things aren't. So it's I think the criminal justice system is a lot more complicated than what we see on TV and what we read in books and that sort of thing. And a lot of, more than often, people just don't really understand it. This sort of opens it up a little more to the public about here's some of the flaws with the system that can really, really hurt both sides.
And briefly, Bob, let's talk a little bit about the practice. I mean, Sarah Koenig had tried to contact Jay through a variety of different ways. He wouldn't respond. So they showed up at his house. They didn't get the interview. He accused them later of sort of ambushing them and basically saying that, you know, they did a hit job on him. From what you've been able to see from reading some of the background material, is that a fair criticism?
I don't think it's a fair criticism. Obviously, if they tried to get in touch with him through conventional means and he still wouldn't want to talk to them, I don't see anything wrong with a reporter knocking on the door and saying, look, here I am. This is your chance. Let's talk. And if he thinks that that constitutes ambushing at your own home, I don't know that that's an ambush. When I think of an ambush, I think of somebody strolling up to you when you're on the street and saying, buttonholing you Mike Wallace style, you know, like we used to see in the early days of 60 Minutes. But knocking on your door, that's not an ambush.
Well, and clearly the podcast has, and all this controversy surrounding it the last couple of weeks has really raised the stakes, Ernest, for podcasting and what Serial is going to do for its next enterprise.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, people are really gravitating toward this, and I think part of it is because they can actually listen to it whenever they want to and follow along to hear what the next thing is going to be. I mean, it has that kind of stick-to-itness, I guess you could tell.
Well, that's all the time we have. We'll be following Serial, obviously, as it develops over the next several months. But that's it for this week's program. Thanks to Ernest and Bob for their insights. And Bob, something tells me retirement is kind of one of those relative terms when it's applied to you, even if you're not going back to the Missouri Net. Thanks as well to our technical team, RJI's Travis McMillan, KBIA's Pat Akers, and Austin Federa. Finally, thank you for listening and watching. You can check out our links blog at kbia.org. You can join the discussion on our Facebook group or on Twitter at Views on KBIA. I'm Mike McKean. Amy Simons will be back in the driver's seat next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.